good evening to where you are in the world. And we just want to welcome you and thank you for participating in this special 3-week series of learning of our learning cafe that's entitled Understanding the Wounds in Our Lives and Expanding Our Perspective While Healing Our Wounded Souls. I just want to introduce myself this morning. I am Nancy Reipold with SIM, and we have been missionaries on the field for the last 25 years, following 14 years of ministering to orphans and widows and vulnerable children in Zambia. God sent us to Monrovia, Liberia, during which the Ebola crisis occurred. I am one of those who have survived Ebola, and following and re after recovery, we returned to Liberia and I began to serve in our trauma healing ministry. Currently, I serve as the Global Trauma Healing Coordinator for SIM and as the ministry point person. It is my pleasure to represent SIM on the Trauma Healing Executive Committee. And I am a master facilitator in the Classic Program, the Children's Program, and a certified mental health coach. But I just want to welcome you this morning, and we want to welcome Mary Beth, our special speaker. Let's just go over a few housekeeping rules this morning. I want to invite you to share your name and where you're zooming in from in the chat, if you feel comfortable in doing that. And please feel free to write any questions that you might have in the chat box, and we'll address them at the end of our presentation in our question and answer. At this point, we would like for you to turn off your video and turn off or mute your sound so that we can begin our sessions. These learning cafes are normally offered to workers within SIM to support our value of lifelong learning. But however, for this series, we felt that the topic was so important that we opened it up to people working outside of our organization and to those who have been part of this organization years ago as children and as teens. We have prepared this time with love and care, and you all are very welcome. But without further delay, it is my joy and my privilege to introduce our speaker, Mary Beth Poole. Mary Beth is an SIM missionary kid who attended Kent Academy in Nigeria from 1963 to 1972, and whose life journey has been one of sorting out the impact of missionary kid life while with an awareness that her story is part of a bigger part of God's story. At the age of 14, Mary Beth struggled with severe depression and suicidal ideation. Through professional help and a growing awareness that she is a much loved and highly valued child of God, she emerged from that dark time with a desire to find joy and wholeness for herself and others. After completing a master's degree in biblical counseling, she counseled and cared for people, many of whom were severely traumatized. Mary Beth was also a member of the Shepherd's House and co-authored Living from the Heart Jesus Gave You and Narcissism Among Us. Mary Beth finds joy in close friendships, nurturing those which she plants in the worn-out shoes of her special friends for whom she prays, and watching detective stories, enjoying the majesty of African animals, and looking for ways to demonstrate kindness at every opportunity. Mary Beth, it is wonderful to have you as our special speaker, and we thank God for you. And I have a pair of shoes for you.
Oh, good. I have to make sure I give you my address at the end of our time.
Mary Beth, I want to turn it over to you now. Welcome.
Thank you. I really do appreciate each of you giving me some of your time and effort and energy and you joining me. It's not a, I don't take it lightly. This series is focused on trauma issues, so we could easily assume that I'm going to focus and look at mostly what happened at boarding schools. But actually, the topic is so much bigger. All of us have relational challenges. All of us have patterns that we've developed as a result of our early childhood, and it plays out in our relationships, whether it's children with, whether it was children with the boarding school staff. All the adults have challenges in how they relate with each other. And so I am hoping that the content that we have will, in addition to help us to go forward with healing from trauma, that you'll all be able to find some helpful nuggets that help you with every relationship that you have. Last week, we looked at how we're designed by God for connection and how devastating it is when we have disconnection in our lives. And that we were designed to tune into whether we are safe in relationships. And the nervous system that God wove into us before we're even born is tuning in to see if we are really understood, if we are cared for, if we are wanted, if people are going to join us, if they think that we're worth it. This is the safety system within us that stays pretty hyper alert as to how safe we are. And we're going to build on this foundation and look more specifically at how attachments are formed in relational styles. So, like we did last week, I want us to just take a minute and to do a little bit of grounding and to get our bodies comfortable. If we go through hard times, it's important that we have something to come back to help us to just get calm. And if any of the material is hard, and you notice yourself having heightened emotions, feel free to take care of yourself. If you have to step out of the room, do that, take some deep breaths. And so, what we're going to do is roll your neck around a little bit and scrunch up your shoulders. Take a deep breath in. And as you're doing that, bring to mind something that makes you smile on the inside. You can really appreciate. It might be remembering a friend where you went out to lunch with someone and it was just a really good time. For me, I love looking at African animals and seeing the spots on the leopards and giraffes. Oh my goodness, it's like they're walking around with stained glass cathedrals on themselves. And so finding anything that you can take your mind to. And while you're breathing in and scrunching up your neck, as you relax and let your breath out, think of the thing that just makes you pleased, happy, grateful on the inside. And we're going to take one more breath. And keep that in mind throughout the class. So if you have upset feelings coming on, take a breather. Back in the 1970s, there was a lady called Mary Ainsworth who was studying, doing research to find out how children develop relational patterns. And she came up with an experiment called the Stranger Experiment. And you can go online, type in those words, and you can find extensive information and video clips. It's absolutely fascinating. So what she did was she came up with the experiment where there was a room set aside for the mother and the child to come in the room and to look around, get orientated, and then the mother would leave the room. Oh, then a stranger would come in And the baby could see that this person knows mom, and then the mom would leave. And then after a little bit of the child playing, then if the child was too upset, the stranger would try to interact with the baby. And then after a little bit, the mom would come back in. The children were between the ages of 9 to 18 months. And there was an observer that was there, and during the whole, all the different phases, the observer was looking for what was the emotional tone in the child when mom left. Was the child able to receive reassurance that mom's going to be back? Was the child not able to receive any comfort and reassurance? Did the child feel comfortable playing alone or anxious and refused to? And then when mom came back into the room, what was it like for the child to reconnect? And out of these, the different categories that they were looking for, it became pretty obvious that there were some main categories, which were the secure attachment, an avoidant dismissive attachment, and an anxious, ambivalent, and resistant attachment. The experiment kept on going for years, and in the 1990s, they came up with another attachment, which was the disorganized attachment. And there's another one, which is the reactive attachment pattern, which we're not going to go into too much in depth. The children that were in a secure attachment, the child felt very confident that mom or the caregiver would be available if there was a lot of stress. They used the connection that they had with their mom to be able to be soothed, to be comforted, to gain a confidence that that it's still going to be okay. When the mom left, there was an appropriate amount of upset and crying. But it was moderate, and the child could be okay shortly afterwards as they waited for mom to return. When mom came back, there was an easy reconnection with the mom. For the avoidant attachment, these children showed very little interest of being dropped off or the reunion with mom. They were very avoidant of both the mother and the stranger. They seemed to be overly independent, and they didn't seem to be at all under any kind of distress when mom left. They had a real seeming indifference to being alone. They picked up toys, played with them. Now, later, when the test continued, they would attach little electrodes to the child's hands. And what they noticed is, although these children in the avoidant attachment pattern category appeared to be the most well-adjusted, they actually had their little heartbeats just escalate, and it was they were very internally disorganized and showed a lot of fear. For the anxious and the ambivalent, the resistant attachment, these children were more clingy when mom left. They weren't able to receive any kind of reassurance or comfort. But simultaneously, while they wanted to be comforted, they were extra frustrated with mom, and they would have this almost a defiant mixture of frustrated, pushing mom away, being mad at her. And when mom did return, they didn't avoid mom, but they didn't experience too much comfort. So there was a real mixture of emotions that went on for these children. With the disorganized attachment, the child was primarily just shut down whenever mom left the room. The child would vacillate between being very frozen or running away and running towards the parent in a disorganized manner when the mom came back. It was like the child knew they needed to reconnect and wanted to reconnect with the parent, but at the same time, they showed a lot of fear. One of the video clips was just heartbreaking for me. There was a little child who mom came in the door and called the child over, and the child ran to the back of the room and was down on her little hands and feet. I think it was a little boy. And he was hitting his head on the floor as he backed up trying to get to mom, and then would run off in one direction and run to another one. And it was just a lot of chaos within the child as the child tried to connect with mom. The next pattern that we're not going to go into really is the reactive attachment. And this might be described as like an escalated, disorganized pattern. And the child often had unexplained withdrawal, fear, was very listless and withdrawn. And they had no seeking desire to seek comfort. And they didn't show any response if comfort was being offered to them. Very often they had an escalated over-the-top behavioral problems as they continued to grow up. And it's understood that the cause of this attachment pattern is due to the initial years where there was a severe lack of bonding with birth parents or the initial caregivers. Often these children lived within foster care or institutional living, and there was frequent changes in the living situation. And often these children were children who were adopted. And there was not a chance for bonds to form at the beginning of life. If we tie these patterns in with last week, the dorsal and the sympathetic system is always on high alert as to, am I safe? Am I going to be able to confidently relax because someone is there for me? And can I then engage in my world, or am I going to be reactive in order to somehow create the best illusion of safety? So we have the secure attachment pattern, where a person's polyvagal system has an ebb and flow of going into high alert. There is danger. Oh, I can get back to calm, or else we have the insecure patterns. We can have a blend of all three of these patterns. In fact, all of us do. The relational dance steps that we develop play out in our relationships from early childhood on, as you can see in the experiments that I just told you about. And they impact all of our interactions throughout life with ourselves, with others, and with God. The internalized patterns impact how we experience others, how we see them, how we hear them, what we interpret, what they express. Because we are so on guard and trying to find out a safety issue, it impacts how we go about creating environments for others to relate in. It impacts how we go forward in developing and pursuing unity and peace and love. It impacts how we pursue, whether it's individually or as a community, being people who are recognized as whether we are representative of the children of God. If we have character that is kind, that is patient, that is long-suffering, that is gentle, if we have impulse control, self-control, or if we are reactive and hurtful to others. We can grow in understanding the systemic relational dynamics that are foundational, regardless of whatever space we find ourselves in, connected with the mission. The content that we go over today is applicable to us who are adult MKs who grew up in the mission and at a boarding school, and many of us were hurt while we were there. And it impacts those who have the sense that they had a pretty good experience. The content is applicable to parents who sent their children away to boarding school, to those who were or are in leadership roles, to those who have children or grandchildren and they want to help them to grow up in secure relationships. It's applicable to those who want to listen and support those who have been wounded and listen to pain-filled stories. It is applicable to all of us who desire to pursue our own healing and repair, restoration, and healing in any relationships. Our adaptive attachment patterns have a profound impact on the effectiveness that we will have in our daily relationships, whether we're single or married, if we have children or don't. How the relational dances play out in developing and restoring relationships and growing towards having earned secure bonds, and how restoration will proceed or not in ongoing healing within our mission from the leadership and trickle down into every individual, including those who were harmed within the mission and those who were not. To the degree that we ponder and con the content of this attachment pattern, we will have a shift that I mentioned last week in regards to Dr. Bruce Perry's book. We're going to grow in our ability to be curious rather than judgmental. We'll be able to ask questions like, "What, wonder what happened to you that brought you to this place in your life?" We'll be able to recognize how some people live out of a nervous system that's very highly energized and full of anxiety, and that they're attempting to either get other people to feel better and get calm so life can be calm and safe, or else the energy is directed to, "I need you to pay attention. I need to connect and be cared for." We're going to recognize when other people live from a place of real shutdown. And we will see that they live as a way in ways to minimize the dynamics of emotional content. They are very dismissive and avoidant, and they won't engage in the emotional life of other people or themselves. Also, we'll be able to make more sense of people who live in very emotionally disorganizing lives. At times, they might get very energized in how they relate, or else other times they would revert to being very shut down and stay distant. To the degree that we understand ourselves and the patterns within others, we can go forward in a focused way towards healing and better tailor our interactions in ways that can be helpful. We'll be less judgmental and much more interactive with compassion and curiosity. Now, I could spend an hour easily on each of the categories, and I noticed that if I try to just talk about them, I'll just lose track of time, and there's no way we will get through the material. And this morning, I wasn't able to get through all the material. So I think my plan, which I did this morning, but we still didn't get through the material. I noticed that I need to have it very contained and stay on track. And the questions that you all come up with, if I don't finish, I'm gonna bring them back up at the beginning of next week and kind of tie things together before we go into our last topic. So you're going to get me to do mostly reading, so I can keep myself on track. There's a lot of material available, so feel free to go onto Google. You can look on my web page. I've written different blog posts about all the different topics as well. So first of all, well, let me read a quote to you by Henry Nouwen. He's talking about attachment when he writes about being in a place where you feel so truly safe and so well held that the ups and downs of your life aren't able to overly distress or excite you. Now, that is a good capturing in a really beautiful way what a secure attachment is, that we have a safe base, that we know that we're not alone, that we have someone who has our back in a real competent way. So let's keep on looking at the secure attachment first. Attachments are formed mostly in the first 18 months of life, and then there's developmental spurts, growth spurts in the brain. So on up till about 5 or 6, things are getting cemented in place. And it's too big of a topic, but very fascinating on how whatever is happening within the caregivers is getting biochemically reproduced within the child. And this is the foundation that then the rest of life is built upon. So if you have a good secure base, when hard things happen in life, it's more likely that they will be hard things and not turn into a trauma. So having a secure, in the secure attachment in those first months and years is absolutely vital. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to give a description of what the attachment is. Then I created like a little story, a picture of what the upbringing would look like for each of the different patterns. And then I want us to look at, well, how would that impact each of us in the way that we perceive God? And if we feel comfortable even having him in our life and what it would look like if we do or don't. So for the secure attachment, the description of the upbringing would be something like this. In infancy, parents delight in their little bundle of joy. They are enthralled with how the child develops. Just their existence makes them smile. And this is going to go on throughout the whole entire growth process of their child. The parent will tune into the infant's specific physical and emotional needs. They will connect in a timely manner to whatever need arises. As the child develops, the parents recognize the value and values the infant's uniqueness, their preferences, their individuality, and encourage them to flourish in these uniquenesses. The child knows that she has a secure base to come back to after being out in a bigger world. The child is encouraged to express her thoughts and opinions and talk about the hard times that come up in growing up. Her parents stay involved, helping her learn to voice her needs, to receive help as needed, to take care of herself, to empathize and appropriately care about and for others. The child is encouraged to try new things and can do so with confidence due to the secure base in life provided for by the family. The family environment sets the stage for a child to be able to return to a place of inside joy and peace and calm as she can, at no matter what kind of situation she's been in. As the child grows, she learns what brings her personal satisfaction and joy. She has opportunities provided in which she can learn the power given to her by God to bring life to other people. She doesn't have to be over-concerned with her own protection. From what she experienced in the family, she has a good representation of what God is like, helping her to transfer confidence to God. Due to knowing well that God is all he claims to be as she grows, she has confidence as she goes through life, having him as a secure base and resource, and always acting and investing in her best interest. She's looking forward to having the adventures that are to come. She's not fearful of the mistakes she'll make as she relates to her family, her friends, her coworkers, and whoever crosses her path. She's not unnerved by the many things that she must learn. She's non-defensive and she's an eager learner. At the times when interpersonal conflict arises, she doesn't withdraw in fear or become angry and demanding. Instead, she interacts with the person, pursuing mutual care and respect if at all possible. When difficult situations occur, she's not reactive. She calmly takes the time needed to learn fully what the situation is before responding. In complex situations, her response is often helpful to everyone involved, and people feel comfortably supported when she is there. She is able to draw out the struggles of another person and reflectively showing that she understands as she joins them on the path that lies ahead. Now, one thing I noted when I was studying the different attachment patterns was I went into a lot of pain in learning about the secure attachment because it reflected back to me what I didn't have, that it was so foreign. And all of us want to avoid pain. It's so uncomfortable to differing degrees. It just brings a big ache inside. And I had to learn and grow in the ability to value and to walk into grieving. Because grieving is actually a way of acknowledging our worth, that we were supposed to have these things. We were valuable enough to be treated and seen this way. And it's a way of honoring who we truly are. So one of the things that I would recommend is that all of us grow in our ability to grieve. And even God values grieving, and he said, weep with those who weep. So again, we see the relational connection that is supposed to be very common in relationships. So I'm going to touch base a little bit more regarding the relational connection with God. So as previously stated, whatever happens in the family unit and with the main caregivers is getting biochemically reproduced within the child. And if she's had a good secure base connection with family, that's going to be transferred into a confidence with God. One with a secure attachment pattern lives with an inner calm and joy in knowing that God's heart towards her is described in 1 Corinthians 13. He's characterized by being patient and kind. He does not get upset when she gets credit and praise, so she doesn't have to put herself down with false humility. She knows that he is desiring for her to be honored and not shamed. He does not hold her sins and mistakes against her, but he keeps a clean slate in his mind towards her. She senses how God believes in her and whatever she's about. His love is persevering. She experiences ways that his loving kindness and goodness and mercy will follow her daily. As a result, there is an easy flow of engagement with God and the world. When hard times come, she's not overly despairing due to a knowing that it's not the end of the story and God is writing the final chapter as a remarkably good one. Being confident that all will be okay, she's not afraid to risk and fail. She enjoys the reality of John 10:9, where Jesus exclaimed, "I'm the gate. Whoever enters through me will be saved. They will come in and go out and find pasture." They have the sense that they have a safe home base from which she can go out, engage in the world, and come back to. I love this concept and how it transfers over into our relationship with God, but I am wanting you to hear this was not my experience, and I've had to work very hard in untangling my past in order to see that this is the ideal of what God desired for me and for all of us. Having a understanding of a secure attachment is needed not only to prevent trauma from happening, but there are huge implications as to what is needed if we're going to relate in ways that enhance restoration, healing, repair in any kind of relationship. The implication of a safe, having a guide for safe relationships, there's huge implications that we need to keep in mind if we want to incorporate them into relationships now in order for there to be any kind of restoration. So I pulled together some more a focused list of different ingredients that are very important to create a initial secure bond and also to work on bonding well with whoever is hurt so that we can go forward in any kind of repair. I have 12 different points here, which are in your handout. The first four of them are very important, especially in what I've talked about with any kind of repair. So these are things that are needed if there's going to be a secure attachment. The first one is attunement on a regular basis and synchronization. A person needs to know that someone is paying attention and sees what's happening in their lives and knows how they're responding to it. And some different questions that you might ask is, for example, did your parents know what you felt at each age? Did they know what you were going through and feeling when you were a toddler? Did they know what you were going through when it was time for you to be sent off to a boarding school? Did they know what it was like when you were working really, really hard to get your math problem figured out and having a hard time? Did they know the excitement when you figured out how to read a book, read different stories, and you could pull the words together? Were they able to feel what you felt when you were having trouble with classmates and you didn't know how to resolve a problem? It's important for us at each age to have the sense that we feel felt. And the parent or whoever is synchronizing and joining us in our experience. And from that, we'll go to number two, responsiveness. The child needs to have a consistency with the caretaker being very present and available whenever is needed. So we can ask questions like, how did your parents respond with whatever you felt? Was it very meaningful? Or was it reactive? Was it very dismissive? Were you just minimized and brushed aside? Or did you feel that they really care and they're excited when things go well? They can rejoice when I'm rejoicing and they can weep when I'm weeping. Based on the responsiveness, the third point is engagement. We need to know that our parents pursued getting involved in a way that was non-intrusive. One thing that sometimes happens, that parents can be so busy with whatever is happening in life that they forget to pay attention to their kids. So then all of a sudden it clicks in their mind, oh, I wonder how my kid is doing. And then without paying attention to what's happening in their child's life, they can overwhelmingly just jump in. And so any type of engagement has to be done on their timetable, and not based on the child's needs. So some questions that you might want to ask yourself is, did your parents pursue getting to know you with all of your uniquenesses and all your idiosyncrasies? And how did that play out when you were in first grade, when you were in fifth grade, when you were a teenager and you're having a whole new set of hormones kick off and being able to to have a sense that mom or dad are engaged in just helping me through each step. When that happens, and we feel that they are tuned into us, they're joining us, they're synchronizing with us, there's consistency in being present, we feel very validated, we do matter, what we're going through is important, and we are then able to receive comfort, and we can then have our emotions regulated. So regulation starts out with co-regulation, interactive co-regulation with the other person. And as that happens over and over in a consistent manner, our nervous systems learn how to do self-regulation. So we can ask questions such as, did your parents help you gain comfort and soothing? Were they with you to help you back into a window of tolerance whenever you were upset? Within interpersonal interactions, were you able to gain peace? The fifth point that I have here is parental emotional strength. Were your parents strong enough to allow you to have really big emotions? Or did you sense that you were going to have to be emotionally okay in order for them to be okay, and then the world to be safe? The sixth one is repair. Were your parents willing to repair relationship when they hurt you? Did they own responsibility for wrong that was inflicted? The seventh one is having a competent, gentle protector. We all need to experience having very active advocates, someone who has our back in a non-reactive, but also very proactive way in creating safe environments and havens. The eighth one is what I have here is eye contact. One of the most important, powerful aspects of safety is if you have good eye contact and you know that you're being looked at with delight, that you have someone whose eyes light up. You're a sparkle in their eye. If you walk in the room, you can spot someone across the way and their eyes, it's like they beat. There's a beam gleam. It's like, oh, there's my person. And it creates a sense of safety of not being alone and disconnected. The ninth one is face-to-face interactions. There's something beneficial that can happen with letter writing, with phone calls, with texts, with emails, even with these Zoom appointment calls that we're having even now. But there's still something missing, that there's within a millisecond, something happens from brain to brain contact when you're with the person, rather than that little lapse within like the Zoom approach. So we needed to have and still need to have as much face-to-face interaction as possible. The 10th point is truthfulness and authenticity. Do we really know what our caretakers were going through and what they say? Is it true? Are they hiding things from us? If this isn't happening, then the child will pick up something is wrong, but they don't have something that matches, and it leaves this incongruent sense of confusion and a lack of self-confidence within a child. So it's very important for parents to be very honest and authentic. I'm not saying that they need to share everything. In life, there's definitely a place for age appropriateness of what you do share, but it's very important that on a consistent basis, that the child has a sense of there's authenticity and I can trust what my mom and my dad are saying. The 11th is playful interactions. Being able to have fun play with someone else is a powerfully bonding experience. And the last one that I have here is relaxation together. Being able to just be quiet together, watching the ocean or listening to music. So that being able to relax together is another very powerful point in having a safe, secure bond. If these are not present, then trauma is happening within the one's nervous system. And trauma is a setup for the insecure attachments. It's a setup for depression. It's a setup for anxiety, for addictions, for OCD, for obsessing on certain topics and tasks, and for hoarding. All kinds of mental and emotional challenges arise if we are not having these kind of elements in our initial bonding. Now, like I said, we can have a mixture and a blend of the insecure patterns, and they might shift based on different situations that are coming up. We're going to look now at the dismissive and the avoidant attachment. And I just want you all to know that this is a case study of me. If you were to Google dismissive attachment pattern, my picture would probably show up. Now, I do have the others, but this was my main default. And it's been a real challenge. And I'm grateful to say that working hard to untangle this can make a difference. So, last week, you might recall that I gave the silent face experiment. So, the attachment, the minimizing and dismissive attachment is when there was an absence of good, strong mothering presence, of a nurturing other. There was disconnection, a sense of abandonment, being cut adrift. No one's there. The child felt more a sense of rejection, of criticism. They were left alone too much. They lacked experience of being delighted in just for the sake of existing. They didn't feel genuinely welcomed. These kids are locked into a bubble of self due to there's no place to land relationally. They're overly self-reliant. They're uncomfortable and asking for help. And they prefer, I should say, we have a preference for pets and plants and technology over people. I'm glad that I like people now, but for most, I would still say most of my life, I would much prefer to have pets and plants and technology. Here's a possible description of the upbringing. Tragically, these children quickly learned the rule that children are to be seen and not heard. They do not experience the faces of their parents lighting up in the delight of who he was. His emotions were dismissed as being a bother, unimportant, and incorrect. The significance of his needs were not recognized and often went unmet. At times, he learned that his need presented an inconvenience to his parents, and if he wanted to avoid the pain of their frustration, being ignored or shamed, he must not let his needs be known. Of course, he wanted to be loved and to be given attention, but he learned not to expect or seek it. He was just a child, so what did he know? He knew that his opinions, feelings, desires were unimportant. And in order to navigate his world, he focused on being a good child. He appeared to be well adjusted since he didn't voice complaints or appear to be a clingy child. This getting it right added to the cycle of not receiving focused attention. There was no need to be met, no behavioral problems to be disciplined. This inflexible and non-spontaneous pattern led him into the path of a very rigid relational style. Those who grow up in this type of environment live with a focus on following rules. If they were not going to be delighted in and cared for, this is the best survival technique they could come up with to stay as safe as possible with their caregivers. Since they had not developed an inner confidence in handling hard situations, they feel a need to have clear guidelines to follow. This becomes more important to the person than entering into the emotional pain or disturbances that occur if you interact with people. These people's creativity and the ability to problem solve are limited due to the main focus is figuring out the rule to follow. They have to figure out the rule in order to minimize upsets that come in life. It's fearful for them to let people have possible negative opinions of him. Thus, he is motivated and guided by a strong shame focus. He's defensive when problems occur and afraid to be found wanting. These fears govern his focus as he tries to be good and not a bother, and this inhibits his capability to learn. Due to his need to keep life seemingly in control, he's not able to enter fully into a difficult situation. To do this, he has to dismiss or minimize the full significance of what he or others are experiencing. Due to growing up in an environment in which his needs, emotions, opinions, and ideas are disregarded, his mind internalized the belief of being unimportant, and later, he's not able to easily recognize his own value. Memories are recorded through a process that includes emotional wiring. Not getting the message that who he is and what he thinks is of any importance. It might have laid the groundwork for life's events not to be logged well in the memory bank. Thus, he has a limited view of himself. He believes that obedience is more important than who he is. He must perform in order to obtain any amount of acceptance or love. Spontaneous and creative thinking has been discouraged, resulting in interpersonal relationships being stilted. His view of life is inflexible, and he takes a very restrictive approach to living in the world. As for a connection with God, tragically, what these people have encountered in their early years is transferred to how they perceive God. They have little awareness that God cares about how they are doing. They are certain that what matters to God is obedience and having a right attitude. They experience God as distant, mostly uninvolved, and a taskmaster. They might know the theological truth of God's love, being unconditional, but their experiences with God are characterized by a dryness and dissatisfaction. They mistake rules for relationship, and thus they would pursue obedience as a way to secure a standing with God. Okay, let's shift and talk about the distracted and anxious attachment pattern. These children develop into being very codependent and very often overly parentified. They need to make sure that their parent and their caretaker is okay in order to create and obtain a stable home environment. They're very afraid of ambivalence and a lack of consistency. Unpredictability is scary. It breaks trust. And internally, the person is just waiting for some type of betrayal to happen. They want relationships, but they don't know how to keep it due to being programmed to wait for the other shoe to drop. They live in an urgency to keep a cry response on. Presenting a need might result in being cared for and addressed and feeling loved. A possible description of an upbringing for these people. I want to tie in something with last week. So the group that we just talked about, where like me, I lived mostly from a sense of being shut down. That's tied into the branch that's called the dorsal branch of the polyvagal system, where the nervous system has figured out, I can't fight the monster and win. I can't run fast enough. So it's best if I just become as invisible as possible. And there's the shutdown. Whereas this category, the nervous system has a high energy going on pretty much all the time, thinking that they might be able to get what they're needing. The parents of these children may truly have desired to give the child attention and love that was needed, yet they were often distracted from doing so by other issues in life that riveted their emotional attention. The squeaky wheel got the grease. Whatever situation had the most emotional intensity determined the parents' focus. This inconsistency in the parents being available, sensitive, perceptive, leaves the child with a sense of uncertainty, giving them an urgent and constant need for comfort from external interactions. At times, parents remembered that their desire to love their child without tuning into his specific needs at the time. They zeroed in on offering attention based on their own time, their own agenda, and an urgency, rather than considering the impact of the child. This lack of sensitivity resulted in emotionally engulfing the child. The child may often feel overwhelmed and anxious regarding future interactions. Internally, they're often consumed and driven by emotional doubts of one form or another. They'll have questions like, am I loved? Will the person leave me? Am I going to be rejected? Will I be cared for only if I have a big enough problem? Will others need to love me on their timetable, drown out my need for timely synchronization? These people have been conditioned growing up to focus on the emotionally demanding situations in life, and thus their mind tracks these types of situations. They learn to attach to emotional crises more than to people. Along with this undercurrent, these individuals are often very caring, gravitating to care for the underdogs. They can be wonderful caregivers. Yet this can add to a dysfunction. While they receive great appreciation from those they help, they learn that this is the way that they will be able to receive attention and to be loved. And this helps to continue a pattern that started in childhood. Whichever person or event is the most demanding is the one that will grab their attention. They too live with the squeaky wheel gets the oil syndrome. People do know that they're important if a crisis occurs, but if nothing urgent is being presented to those with an anxious attachment pattern, the person might not know if they are truly loved. The pattern of tracking the emotionally charged situations in life result in there being off and on in relationships, depending on the emotional intensity of the moment. His preoccupation with demanding situations might result in his being unreliable relationally, as well as with day-to-day responsibilities. Due to the crisis of the moment, responsibilities often are not taken care of, which results in frustration with him by other people. These people live from a place of insecurity that often plays out with them demanding the spotlight, demanding to be appreciated and respected. Even though they desire to gain security from relationships, they gravitate toward relationships with people who are demanding and frustrated. When these people have a need in their own life, they may be distracted from life's responsibilities as they seek someone to take care of their needs. When they find someone, they tend to become overly dependent for a period of time, being paralyzed and not functioning as well as they wish. These adults often have secret addiction. Although feeling guilty and trying repeatedly to stop, they continue to be drawn towards pornography or food, television, alcohol, compulsive reading, drugs, nicotine. They'll try to remind themselves that they're going to hate themselves later, but the urge for personal excitement or distraction from their anxiety is stronger than self-discipline. The days most barren from personal affirmation and tenderness are the ones they most often give in to an addiction. These individuals' lives are often governed by chaos more than their values and their goals. And to think about how this ties over in the way that they perceive God and connect with Him. Tragically, these individuals carry the undercurrent of anxiety and drivenness into their experience with God. They pursue emotional highs and circumstances being fixed as evidence of God's love. They're more familiar with excitement and joy than with an internal shalom, inner calm and peace. Okay, let's go to the fourth category. And this is the anxious, this is the distracted, the disoriented, and the disorganizing pattern. These people very often are frozen and can't make decisions and move, or else they vacillate between high energy or a complete shutdown. They're paralyzed from moving forward in life. A possible description of these kind of upbringings. Some people tragically grow up in homes fraught with fear. The parent to whom the child needs to go to for security were the ones that brought the child fear. Mothers may have had a high level of fear and anxiety, whose emotions flowed out of her to her children when she relates to them. Remember, whatever is happening within the main caregivers is getting biochemically reproduced within the child. So for example, if the mother is constantly certain that danger was lurking, that the house would be broken into, dad was hurt in an accident if he gets home late, the children are going to get hurt if they play and they climb trees. The child is learning from the parent that the world is not a safe place. The child also may have lived in terror of her father or dorm parent coming home at the end of the day. Would he fly into a rage? Was tonight the night that he would enter her bedroom and violate her? Would he again smash mom against the wall? Yep, it's certain to these children that the world is unsafe. It's not organized. It's not reliable. It will not offer protection and love. Those who grow up in a very chaotic and fearful environment internalize the chaos and the fear. When living with a constant sense of dread and anxiety, they learn that the world and relationships are not safe or reliable, and something bad is going to happen. When a child has no secure or trustworthy caregiver, they have no constancy to build a secure view of the world. When a parent is scary due to outbursts of rage and abusiveness, This is added to their internalized belief that the world is unsafe and unreliable. Parents who are supposed to be a source of comfort were also the source of danger and fear. The child is often left frozen in a stance between avoidance or tracking fear in all situations. As life progresses, the individual struggles with emotional, social, cognitive difficulties. This internal disorganization will impair future interactions with others and inhibit their ability to function well. They'll have a poor coping capacity, a marked inability to regulate emotional responses, an inability to stay focused and on track in life when stressful situations arise. Tragically, they can emotionally disintegrate when hard times arise, and their lives increasingly are characterized by emotional outbursts, implosions, and chaos. It may seem like these people have an internal magnet to fearful situations, since they're constantly in the middle of whatever crisis is at hand. They've had to have a highly alert polyvagal system in order to spot any possible danger or threat. As a result, they are unable to gain a realistic perspective, bringing themselves to a sense of calm. Instead, they may become quite reactive. It's not easy for them to receive the help needed, and they cannot relate in a way that's helpful to others during times of their own disintegration. These individuals lose focus of their personal preferences and values during the times that they are disoriented and internally disorganized. It's important to remember and to know that verbal reassurance is not going to do any good for them. They need to have a calming, safe presence until they are regrounded. There can be a continuum of dissociation. There's different types of dissociation. It might be memory issues or significant incongruity between what they might perceive at a conscious level and what their neuroception is as to whether they are safe or not. These people need to have betrayal blindness, because if they were to know the fullest scope of the harm that has been done, then they're going to fall apart and have it. It'll be like a tsunami comes in and wipes them out. In regards to their relational connection with God, tragically, this results in these individuals experiencing their relationship with God as tumultuous and confusing. Internally, they live with fear and certainty that God is scrutinizing and tracking their failures and is disappointed, angry, and impatient. This keeps them in a disorganized relational stance with God, wanting to be loved and cared for, but simultaneously afraid of going close to Him. So, the personal goal for all of these patterns is for us to go towards an earned, secure attachment pattern. What we want to be able to do is to heal enough that we're able to grow into being a secure person for other people. Nancy, I'll let you go ahead and switch to the next slide. Oh, Hyun. Good, thanks. What is needed most for repair is that we understand our life story and that we understand how it impacts who we are today and how we relate. Self-awareness and reflection is the most powerful way for us to move towards becoming a secure, attached person to other people and for other people to attach to. I'm going to quickly give a overly generalized, it's way too minimized of what is needed in the different patterns. And then next week, I'll try to expand to talk a little bit more of how these patterns interact with each other and clash and make things extra messy, relationships messy, and hinder us from healing. But very briefly, if we are in a dismissive attachment pattern and we're shut down and we've learned to minimize everything, it's so important for us to start making a mountain out of a molehill. We have to think that whatever we've thought is a big deal, is a little deal, is probably a big deal, but we weren't able to know it. We need to give ourselves permission to be drama queens and kings, to make a big deal. And what I found is for me, when I started to make a big deal out of something, I actually was just being normal. So explore ways that you can break the rules, that you can push the limits of traditions, that you can get out of rigid comfort zones, you can color outside the lines. Some examples would be going into a restaurant and the person says, the host says, "Would you like to sit over here at this table?" And look around and say, "No, I think I would like that one." And notice what happens in your nervous system. Is it okay to make a big deal out of something like that? And or if the waiter says, comes by, and "How was your food?" Be willing to say, "Well, the meat was a little bit rare. Would you please take it back?" And be willing to cause waves and to make a big deal out of something. For people who are in the distracted, the anxious, and the preoccupied pattern, they're the ones who are very anxious and high energy. So for them, it's going to be important to learn ways to get themselves back to a place of internal calm. The next one was the disorganized attachment pattern. And these people are going to need constant, stable, mature people to walk life's journey with them for the long haul. They'll need to have help in learning and developing many brain skills. And four important ones are mindfulness, being able to tune into themselves and what's happening, and to be able from there to get to a place of calm, regain calm, to build joy rather than tracking fear, and to develop emotional capacity. Actually, all three of the insecure attachment patterns, it's important to increase in self-awareness, to use our five senses to either get to a place of calm or to activate our internal system and to have more energy in life. If we're able to understand these dynamics, hopefully we will develop an increased sense of compassion for those that we are in relationship with. We can grow in our ability to relate in ways that will be helpful rather than hurtful and judgmental. So next time I'll expand a little bit more on how the different patterns clash and make things harder to go towards any kind of repair and healing. But I will send this back to Nancy, and she will share some comments from you all in the chat or questions.
Mary Beth, thank you. We have learned so much from you this morning. Thank you for sharing even your own story and just where you have been and the pains that you've walked through. And I really appreciated too that you validated grieving. That is so important. And Hyan had a question. Could you explain more how we can engage in healthy grieving?
Oh, that's a good question, Hyan. For me, I've had to make a big deal out of things that like mountains out of molehill. So being able to pay attention to I feel sad, or I just had a good time with friends, but somehow it wasn't enough. I wonder why it wasn't enough. Wow, do I ever have a big hole in my life that whatever love I get kind of just drops through the bottom. Well, I wonder what that's about. Being sad that for me, it's being sad that I'm still single. I know that my attachment pattern created the internal dynamics that made it hard for me to be able to bond to other people. And I had my guard up, or I minimized desires. So realizing that if things had been different, I might be married. Grieving, I might be watching a movie, and I notice that tears start to come up. And it's like, oh, that's touching into something. I wonder what's touching into for me. How has that played out in my life in a positive or a negative way? And just then sitting in the emotion. For me, there's different types of ADHD, and I have a deep limbic one where my brain just pops all over the place, and it's hard to stay focused on something that is painful. My brain wants to get away from it. So it's like, oh, let me go back to that movie. What was it that was happening that touched into something, and to think, well, did I have that or did I not? What's the impact that I didn't have it? For people who are very highly energized, for them to have self-awareness with, I have a lot of energy in trying to get this person to like me. I have a lot of energy going on that I need to get the world to feel safer. I've got to fix problems. I wonder what's happened that that's become such an urgent desire, drive within me. Oh, wow, I didn't have people that liked me a whole lot when I was growing up. That really is sad. How did it impact my view of myself? And just asking a whole lot of questions and growing the ability to sit in emotion. You can read a lot more on my webpage regarding growing emotional capacity, but that's important if we're going to be able to grieve well. Hope that helps some, Hyun.
Thanks, Mary Beth. I think that it's really important too. And you could even maybe talk about lamenting in our grieving. And that's a great
Absolutely.
way to just really to walk with the Lord in those areas of hurt and pain. Thank you, Mary Beth, for sharing that.
I want to throw one little comment in. I wasn't able to enter into grief with God for a long time because I did not experience at the level my perception. If we go back to last week, might be able to tell you rational reasons that God would care and would grieve with me. My neuroception was it's not a big deal to God, and he'll be upset if I'm not happy. So for those who aren't able to grieve with God, that's okay. Go ahead and grieve, and it's part of our journey.
Being part of normal, right?
Part of normal, yes.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Mary Beth, Neil asks the question, how do I help with a disorganized attachment? How do I help a person with a disorganized attachment come to healing? Do you want
Oh,
another hour or so?
how about five?
Yeah.
Neil, people who have the disorganized attachment, they're the ones that are going to have the hardest time, and they're not needing answers because it's the level of their nervous system that's upset. So they need someone who's going to be present, someone who's going to be able to tune into and see, I understand why you're upset. I see how this hits you. I see how you weren't listened to well, how you were minimized. They need someone who sees them, who hears them, who understands them, who gives them the message, I'm going to be here for the long haul. They're going to need at times to have you tune into how high and eruptive their emotions are, and for you to be able to be a calm presence with them when they're upset, not trying to fix and get them calm, but just to be with them so they're realizing that they're not disconnected. It's a hard, long journey.
And Mary Beth, a further question that he asked was, if a person didn't receive what was needed for that secure attachment, will providing those things in adulthood help them to wholeness, or is there some other intervention needed?
They absolutely will need to have someone walking with them for the long haul, with all the things that I listed on this. I think there were 12 different things to have a secure relationship, a secure bond. They will need to have that. There can be other kinds of interventions. There can be, you can find people who understand the polyvagal system and can very precisely tune into which branch is dysregulated, and here are ways to specifically get that branch more regulated. There's usually EMDR is more tricky. That's not a necessarily a wise approach, but it might work for some people who are in the disorganized. A lot of the deep breathing and to ground, help someone to ground themselves is really important, to learn how to internalize attachments that they have currently into their nervous system now. So you're doing repatterning of attachments is good. So there's a lot of different approaches that you can add to the things that I listed in that, the list of what's needed for a good approach, a good relationship. Hope that helps some.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Tom asks a question. He says, some emotional detachment in childhood and through adolescence caused one to live in a way that was self-centered and self-seeking. I think of those things as sinful, yet they seem to have come from the lack of growing in my growing years. Where do we draw the line between understandable reactionary living and sinful behavior?
Come back next week. I'm going to talk about
it's a great question. It's a great question, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, it is. We want to be able to live the heart of Jesus without weaponizing truth. And if we come too hard at someone who's been very wounded with principles that I really do value, but you come at them too harshly, you're just going to re-traumatize a person. In the book that I wrote, Narcissism Among Us, I talk about people who have narcissistic traits. So the world then revolves all around them and them getting their needs met and them being appreciated and them being valued. The deeper, the more significant, the longer, the earlier that wounds start, it will be reflected in the level of narcissism that a person has. So being able to recognize, quote, sinful behavior and see, oh, this is where it comes from. Let me be able to hold two realities at the same time, that it's coming from a lot of woundedness, and I want to be very gentle and tender. And also to be able to put some guidelines of, this isn't going to go well for you. This is going to backfire and hurt you. here's some structure of what is good for you, and to help them to live out ways that care for others and not just themselves is a way for them to get what they want to really be valued. If giving correction to a person, and advice and logical thinking, if that works, then that's great. If a person has a hard time to take in the advice and then to live life well, then it's like, I think I need to take a bottom-up approach, and I need to enter into what's happening at the level of their nervous system from the trauma in their past. So you want to hold both at the same time and have guidance just through practice in which one do you want to stress at a time. Hopefully that ha helps some.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary Beth. Mary Beth, I know that there are lots more questions, and I think that you mentioned on the onset that that you would try to answer those questions at the beginning next week. Is that correct?
Yes, I was this morning in an interaction with Hayan and the others. I was told that questions that you all put in the chat box are going to be saved and sent to me and organized. So I will do my best to flesh them out at the beginning of next week.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Mary Beth, just in closing, Catherine wanted to know, we'll be hearing more next week about how to help insecure people move towards more secure attachment patterns. Can you just give us a little bit more of a taste of what you might be sharing next week?
It really differs depending on which attachment pattern is activated. And so, the way to help someone who is caught in a lot of the dismissive attachment pattern and they don't have a freedom to know that they're important and special and valued, you would help them in a different way than someone who's very anxious. With one, you're wanting to help them to be able to make the mountain out of the molehill and to recognize how valuable they are. With the other, you're wanting them to know you really do matter, and it's not dependent on how your parents treat you. You don't have to run after them. So I do hope to touch into that more specifically. And with someone who's in the disorganized, they live from both patterns. And so you approach going forward in healing based on whatever is being activated within them.
Thanks, Mary Beth. And thank you all for
Thank you all.
joining us. We would love to see you again next week. Please open your cameras and